Thursday edition of the Dunk Dive Basketball Podcast. Last night, we did part one of our playoff preview, including the Western Conference, and wrapped up Wednesday night's action. Now we're going to get to the East and maybe some news as well, if we have time, since there has been some stuff that's come down since the end of the season already. We're sponsored today by Betterment. Go to betterment.com/capspace to get up to 6 months of no fees for lower cost automated investing. And by the HBO special J. Cole, For Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film airing 10 Eastern, 11 Pacific on Saturday, April 15th. All right, let's get right to it, Danny. We're just going to go in order of the seeding. We'll start with the 1-8 series, the Chicago Bulls and the number one seeded Boston Celtics.
Still feels weird to say, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, they've been the favorite for a time in the 538 odds, although I guess we never really quite believed it. And it's also interesting to think that had Cleveland played their guys, you'd have to imagine they probably would be the number one seed. I mean, all they needed, they had the tiebreak. They only finished one game behind, right? Or did it end up being two?
Well, no,
it ended up being two.
Boston won that last game. So even if Cleveland had won against Toronto, they still would have gotten the two seed.
Yeah, and they would have had to play their guys against Miami, you imagine, since they took them into overtime without Irving and James. But, you know, they opted for health, and I think given the level of confidence that they have coming from the number two seed, which they did in 2015, just seeing what LeBron James can do when he's healthy and engaged in the playoffs, what Kyrie Irving has done at times in the playoffs as well when he's healthy, they prioritize that. Probably the right decision. And we'll see now what Boston could do. You know, we were asked yesterday on the Twitter NBA show, which we did in kind of like a red zone style type of thing. We were asked who had the biggest chance in the East of pulling an upset. And I actually, just eyeballing it, thought it was the Bulls. Then KP had a column last night saying he thought it was the Bulls as well, based on his model for playoff performance, which incorporates a few things like shortened rotations and the regular season series, which can have an impact in the first round. He's found that that's potentially a significant factor. How much of a chance are you giving the Bulls? Like, if you had to just eyeball it in terms of their percent chance actually winning the series, what'd you say it is?
1-3, 33%.
Whoa, 1-3. That is incredibly high. I wouldn't go that high. I mean, for it still is a 1-8 series. You know, I would say maybe more like 20% for me.
That's actually 20% is where I was going originally, and I'm like, that seems too low. So then I was gonna go 1-4, and then I went, I should have settled on 1-4 instead of 1-3, made it a little bit more temperate. But like, I think the reason why I'm a little bit higher on their chances of winning the series, though I still, that doesn't mean I think this is necessarily going to go long, is that I see a pretty cohesive theory of how the Bulls could do it, just because Boston's offense is so reliant on Isaiah, and Isaiah is fabulous, and I expect that he will do well, but the lack of other alternatives in case he starts to stumble, and the big disparity, which I think is kind of the definitive part of the series other than how the Bulls defend Isaiah, is Boston is a terrible defensive rebounding team. Chicago not only has offensive rebounding talent, but actually tries for it. And that could create the difference in a game or two, which could be enough.
Yeah, the Bulls, though, have dropped off since the early part of the season when they were really propping up their offense with fouls and offensive boards. But I do think that Robin Lopez could be a slight problem. I actually don't really care, though. I understand that the fundamentals for Chicago and Boston are pretty close. I mean, Boston has like a 2.5 point differential in Chicago, although buoyed by an Orlando team that wasn't trying and a Nets team that wasn't trying. I mean, they won their last two games by like a combined like 70 points or something, giving the Magic their worst defeat in franchise history on Monday. So the Bulls point differential is probably buoyed a little bit. And I also don't really like the way this Chicago team matches up very well with Boston, especially defensively. You mentioned Isaiah Thomas. The Bulls don't really have an option to defend him. Jimmy Butler is a great defender on bigger wings, strong, competes, but I don't think that if they're going to put him on Isaiah Thomas, chasing him around dribble handoffs the entire game, he's not going to have enough energy for offense. Rajon Rondo, not known for his defense. He can get engaged every once in a while, but over the course of a 7-game series, I don't expect him to be able to keep up. Jerry and Grant, is he going to guard Isaiah? Are they going to unearth Michael Carter Williams and see if he can guard him. Dwayne Wade, if he has to switch onto him, has no chance at all. Denzel Valentine. I mean, their smalls are just not very good defensively, not the type of players that you look at that have given Thomas problems in the past, and he's much better than ever before. So I expect Isaiah to have a monster series. That's number one. Number two, you mentioned the defensive rebounding. Yeah, okay, that could be a little bit of a problem for Boston, but I'll tell you what's a bigger problem for Chicago is Robin Lopez trying to guard Al Horford on the perimeter. We've seen Boston just destroy a team like the Jazz. Rudy Gobert is a lot better than Robin Lopez is. I think Lopez, especially if these games are close late, is going to get played off the floor. And we've just seen Boston has worked the Bulls, especially both times in Boston. They created basically the nadir of the Bulls season a couple of months ago on ABC, and then an early game during the year, the Bulls were able to come back late, but you know, got blown out for most of that game as well. So I'm not sure what lineups, especially front court combinations, Fred Hoiberg is going to be able to go to that can be effective defensively.
Something else that worries me from the Bulls' perspective is that they don't have a lot of options in case their primary things don't work. You know, they have a very shallow bench after trading McDermott and Taj Gibson for Cameron Payne, who is, you know, a limited part of their rotation at best. And so if Lopez is having trouble on Horford, are they going to turn to Cristiano Felicio? Like, where are they going to go with this if those elements struggle? Whereas let's say Boston trying to guard Jimmy Butler, they have a series of different guys who can work, and that also allows them to stay fresh in a way that
I wouldn't say that. I think they have two guys. I think Butler is probably too big for Avery Bradley, so it's basically going to be Smart and Crowder. I guess Jaylen Brown they could go to as well. I could see Brown like getting into foul trouble trying to guard Butler, you know, falling for pump fake. Yeah, same thing.
If he's their third or fourth option, that's okay. Yeah. I mean, that's better than the Bulls' options comparatively to guard Isaiah.
No, that's a great point. Yeah, so I don't think that while these teams' fundamentals are closer than you would think, and you could maybe even make the argument that Jimmy Butler, when you throw in his defense, is the best player in the series. I don't think so. I think Isaiah is better than him, but he could end up playing better than Isaiah. And I do see your argument about, hey, you know, maybe like they could take the ball out of Isaiah's hands and the Celtics wouldn't be able to make threes and that would be a problem, but they just don't have the personnel to do that. They don't have bigs who can get out on the perimeter and trap Isaiah. They don't have someone along the lines of an Iman Shumpert, you know, or the trapping defense that the Hawks could deploy to slow down Isaiah. So, I mean, I think the Bulls got to just kind of hope that the Bulls are going to give up a ton of three-pointers in this series, and they just got to kind of hope that the Celtics kind of mediocre shooters miss them.
Something else we also have to mention here is that this is the biggest coaching disparity in the entire first round, and Stevens has been, not only does he have better control of his own team, but I think he's substantially better in terms of making adjustments and reads, and that helps in, if it's potentially long series, we don't know if it's going to be, but it helps and ratchets up the more significant the games are.
Yeah, I agree with you there as well. Another thing is that the Bulls are going to be really dependent on Nikola Mirotic making his shots. Since it's not March, he may not make them. We'll see. I mean, he could definitely get hot a couple of games, and then, you know, I expect those games to be pretty competitive. I don't see the Bulls as having a huge home court advantage in this series. When they get home, by most accounts, the city is unenthused for this Bulls team, and Boston, for a team that has the number one seed, you expect that their fans are going to be pretty riled up as well. So I don't necessarily see, just in terms of the matchup, the more we're thinking about this, I still think it is the most likely upset, just because these teams are pretty close in quality, but I do think that Boston really has the matchup advantage. I mean, what do you think are going to be some of the key questions? We hit on the idea of whether Lopez can stay on the floor late against Horford, whether the Celtics are going to play Amir Johnson at the end. I'm guessing probably not. They'll probably just go with Smart at the three, and Crowder at the four to close games. Maybe Brown will get in there a little bit too. Any other strategic questions that you see for either of these coaches?
Kelly Olynyk, how he functions, where they use him, whether he plays backup center plus some power forward, or whether they bounce it around a little bit. Yesterday against the Bucks, they ended up using him at center, but he got in foul trouble, so they had to use Tyler Zeller, and Zeller was generally pretty awful. So how Stevens manages his big man rotation and whether he goes small more often is a big tactical question, especially because the Bulls, I don't trust their overall wing rotation, so going small challenges them in ways that they might not be able to handle.
Yeah, that's a good point too. This Bulls team now doesn't have Taj Gibson on it anymore. Olynyk, whom you mentioned, he's kind of like the Celtics Celtics Mirotić in some ways, except, you know, he's like the seventh or eighth man on the Celtics. They don't rely on him to perform every game, and the Bulls don't have anybody who's going to really be able to attack Olynyk in the post, which is one of his big weaknesses, getting into foul trouble. Another big time in this series, the Bulls have been, you know, about +2, +3 with Jimmy Butler on the floor in terms of net rating, and like -9 when he's been off this year. You imagine that he's going to have to play a ton of minutes. How many minutes is a ton of minutes going to be? Is Hoiberg going to be able to hold him down to 40, or is he going to be playing like 45 minutes and maybe not have anything left by the end of the game? Or maybe he can't even play that long. You know, that's a possibility too. And then, you know, Dwayne Wade, can he carry the Bulls offense when Butler's off the floor? And then the Celtics, Isaiah, he's played, you know, really only 34 minutes a game and has been incredible in those minutes. Can he ramp up his minute usage as well in the playoffs? I mean, the type of game that he plays, moving off the ball so much, the Bulls will probably also try to get him in small pick and rolls as much as possible down the end of games if these games are close. So is he going to get worn out a little bit? How many minutes can he play? And then what happens when those two stars are off the floor? You know, the Celtics can struggle to score without Isaiah. Obviously, the Bulls without Butler. You know, who's going to win that matchup? I think I do like the Celtics a little better because at least they can defend in the time when their star is off the floor. And I think that's going to be the biggest difference here. I think the Celtics can defend a lot better than this Bulls team.
If the Bulls maximized their rotation and did things like making sure Wade was on the floor when Butler wasn't, I would feel a lot more confident about their prospects there. But they'll do that. But like, and but the rest of their rotation, like, they don't have just kind of the ancillary pieces to make that sing. I mean, they can do okay, but, you know, it's, again, this is going back to the idea that I've been, and I'll talk about this when I make my prediction of this Bulls team versus the talent they had before the trade. Because while I, you know, I can understand why they wanted to move Taj Gibson, who was an expiring contract and everything else, this series in particular, they're hurt pretty dramatically by the guys that they lost in that trade.
Yeah, that's a great point too. And if indeed Lopez cannot stay on the floor late in games, who are they going to go to then? I mean, maybe is it going to be Mirotić at center? I mean, that Felicio is a little more mobile than Lopez, but, you know, a little bit spacey, not really someone that you want playing down the end of games in a playoff game, you don't think, even though I think he has some potential. I mean, is Hoiberg going to go to Bobby Portis, who really, you know, can get hot every once in a while, but is an awful defensive player? Paul Zipser, I think, could be a key figure in this series. You know, is it going to be Zipser and Butler at forward? I mean, if they had Zipser and Butler at forward and they still had Taj Gibson at center, then maybe you could say, all right, that's a lineup that could match up pretty well with this Celtics team. But, you know, obviously they no longer have Gibson. And, you know, so, I mean, it's Mirotić at center. That's going to be inadequate defensively. Lopez is too slow. They just don't have a good option for matching up late in games with the Celtics team. And I think if the Celtics have been unbelievable in the clutch this year as well, I mean, we'll see whether that carries over or not, but you know what Isaiah Thomas has done in fourth quarters. So that's another thing too. I mean, I think some of these games will be close, but I really like how the Celtics match up down the end of games compared to the Bulls, who for their part have really struggled a lot of times in the clutch. That's been a little better lately, but other than just a small pick and roll, or, you know, a 3-5 pick and roll with Jimmy Butler, they don't really run anything else. Whereas Brad Stevens, they run good shit at the end of games.
That they do. Are we ready for predictions?
Yeah. I'm going to go Celtics 7. You know what? No, I'm not going to. Actually, that's what was my pick going in. And in discussing this, I think I'll go Celtics in 6 as well, because I could also see this Bulls team just kind of emotionally laying down in a game 6 at home. So I think I'll go Celtics in 6.
On talent purely alone, I think this is Celtics in 5, but I'm going to go with 6 just because the idea of random chance and variance for a game. You know, I think this Bulls team is capable of swiping 2. So I think it's 6. I'm mad you didn't say 7 just because I think that would have given me a lot of real estate that I was comfortable with. But 6 is the most likely outcome.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're not employing too much game theory in our... I guess we should make you go first for the next series. Too much game theory
kind of
in
de
our
facto
yearly
alternating
competition.
It.
Who won last year, by the way? Do you even remember between us of like who had the picks?
I think I did, but I'm not completely sure.
Yeah, I think I feel like you might have too. I know that
I know
famously
I did two
won.
Years ago.
Oh, you won 2 years ago?
Didn't I?
I thought I did because I got the Clippers Spurs series right and you didn't.
Oh, yeah. Which probably means that I won last year because I seem to remember I won once. So, okay.
Well, you know, I mean, that would be fair, right?
Yeah, that's we agree to it beforehand.
Obviously, this means a lot to us since neither of us can remember what happened. All right, we will get to our next series here, which is the Cavs and Pacers. But first, this is from HBO. We've been telling you about it all week. I'm going to actually watch this thing. J. Cole, For Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film, the Grammy-nominated hip-hop star's second HBO special, which debuts on Saturday, April 15th. That's 2 days from now as we record this. 10 Eastern, 11 Pacific. It's a multi-narrative show that combines music performances with intimate interviews documented through Cole's lens. It showcases songs from his fourth album and also reveals some of the concerns, struggles, the confessions of people living in the American South. Cole captures some of these stories in Baton Rouge, Atlanta, Ferguson, Missouri, Cole's hometown of Fayetteville, North Carolina, his dad's hometown of Jonesboro, Arkansas. And he looks at how these small towns, a lot of them, Jonesboro, Arkansas in particular, resemble the rest of the country in their struggles with integration. Cole's album, For Your Eyes Only, was released a couple of months ago, and it debuted at number one, and it sold 492,000 units in its first week. The New York Times, the not failing New York Times, held it as one of the year's most finely drawn albums and calls Cole a rap star without rap star trappings, a parallel universe champion. So tune in Saturday, April 15th, 10 Eastern, 11 Pacific, for the premiere of J. Cole, For Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film, exclusively on HBO. Well, I think I like the way that these matchups turned out because LeBron James against Paul George is always great theater. The Pacers did beat the Cavs once in a game when LeBron rested at home. Another game this year, the Pacers had won seven straight. Thad Young went out with an injury, and the Cavs just destroyed them, put up a buck 32 on them in the former Conseco Fieldhouse, now Bankers Life Fieldhouse. And then they had a double overtime classic earlier that the Pacers ended up losing, but looked pretty good playing against the Cavs, although a lot of teams have looked pretty good playing against the Cavs, as the Cavs have had basically a neutral net rating since the All-Star break. So I think the number one question for me in this series is just who is going to guard Paul George for this Cavaliers team, and are they going to switch a lot? You know, you saw a lot of miscommunications in that double overtime game that the Cavs improbably ended up winning. That pin downs for Paul George, that's how Tristan Thompson and LeBron started yelling at each other about breakdowns. LeBron wanted Thompson to switch a little bit more. But I mean, really, like the way these teams match up, who else is going to guard George but LeBron James in big moments?
I'm not as much concerned about who's going to guard him in the big moments. I feel like that's going to be LeBron, but those might be the only moments, at least early on, where LeBron guards Paul George, and they don't have many options for that. I mean, this is different than when they faced the Raptors in various series, because they just don't have, you know, that third guy is very different than it is for the CJ Miles, depending on who they want to go with at various moments, you know. So I wouldn't trust J.R. Smith on Paul George. Maybe you use Richard Jefferson for stretches, which is another part of the reason why I was critical of what Cleveland did this past offseason. But something else to remember about this, and while I'm not wringing my hands about Cleveland's post-All-Star break swoon, the Pacers also have a better net rating than the Cavs since January 1st. So this is a little bit of a larger thing. Of course, that part post-All-Star break weighs heavily in that sample, but the Pacers have played pretty well this year. They had that rough stretch at the beginning of the year. Jeff Teague did turn his ankle in the last game, but it sounds like he's not going to miss any playoff games. Granted, not missing and being 100% are very, very different things, but the Pacers are certainly capable. Whether they can put that together against Cleveland, a team that has arguably similar and greater strengths than the Pacers, is a very different question.
Yeah, and if you look at the big problem why the Pacers disappointed this year is that their bench sucked. And, you know, that was obviously a big problem. That's why they lost that Raptors series too, especially because Frank Vogel, you know, just put out some pretty asinine lineups in that game seven, that game five, especially when they blew a huge lead on the road to the Raptors. But this team, much of the core of which is back still, Paul George in particular, I guess that's really, he and Turner are really the only ones, and Miles. But, you know, if they don't have to play their crappy backup bigs, I don't think Al Jefferson is necessarily going to be back. He's a horrible matchup against Cleveland's second unit. But I think with the starters on the floor, Indiana can compete pretty well. We've seen Lance Stephenson actually has looked pretty decent in a Pacers uniform. George has been killing it really the last month and a half or so now. And as we mentioned, the Cavs are swooning, and they really, you know, they have Richard Jefferson and they have LeBron. Those are really the only two true small forwards on this team, I guess, unless you want to go to Dante Jones, who they just signed yesterday. You imagine he's not going to play at all. So, yeah, I mean, Kevin Love can't guard Paul George if they're in their starting lineup. And he might even struggle a little bit to guard Thad Young as well. And, you know, Thompson can switch a little bit, but then JR is too small. Shumpert is too small to guard George, who loves to just come off of pin downs or work in isolations and shoot over the top of guys. And considering how well George is playing right now, and then he can cause problems for LeBron on the other end. You mentioned, I think at the big moments it'll be LeBron guarding him. I mean, he's going to have to guard him at the start of the... unless they put JR on him and then you put LeBron on CJ Miles, I think he's going to have to guard him for like most of this series unless Richard Jefferson is in the game. And, you know, especially if they're running Paul George off screens, that was always LeBron's biggest weakness as a defender, and even in his heyday. And now I don't think he can keep up with him at all.
Yeah, that's something that I've been considering. And also I've been wondering when the Cavs go really more all offense, so they play Love at center or go to some of those real four stretchy lineups, they will be sacrificing something defensively. You know, like those units will have a much harder time limiting when Teague penetrates, when Paul George can get ahead of steam. But I'm not sure that the Pacers can do enough to mitigate those lineups and do enough to score themselves to just make it a real slugfest. Like I don't think they can hang with them in those real high-flying lineups.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, if they close games with Love at center, which I could see them absolutely doing, you know, Miles Turner has to be on the floor. He's just that good of a player. Can he get out on someone like Kevin Love? Are they going to just try to hide him on Shumpert or Richard Jefferson? If those guys are on the floor, that'll be fascinating down the end of games. And I think it'll also be very interesting to see what happens at the start of the second quarter. That typically is the time when Paul George rests. That is also typically the time that LeBron James comes back in. They've actually been playing James at center recently in those lineups, and those lineups have been pretty effective. Or even if James is at power forward, now you have both George out of the game, and then you also have, you know, Kevin Seraphin, or if Al Jefferson can get healthy, or Lavoy Allen, if they're going to play him, like, and that's going against Channing Frye playing as a shooting center, like, that's not going to work. So if there are any times when James is in the game and George is off, I mean, I think McMillan just has to junk his rotation and go very ad hoc and just match up PG with LeBron at all times. If he doesn't do that any time when LeBron is in the game and George isn't, like, they're just going to get completely smacked.
My feeling on this series, and I've kind of thought this ever since the matchup came out last night, is that the Pacers certainly can win. I'm not going to discount that possibility, but this looks to me more like a series where it puts more miles on Cleveland than they want, but that they still win. And that is a very bad thing for Cleveland's chances of making the finals or winning the finals, because by virtue of falling from the one seed to the two, they're also getting a much harder second round series. And I don't want to look too far past it, but I think that could be the enduring legacy of this series should it have one.
Yeah, it just, I like what the starting lineup, and I think actually getting Stevenson, if he's really going to play and play off the bench, you know, he's another guy you can switch on to LeBron. Maybe he can guard him a little bit if George is out of the game. He's obviously has experience doing that, probably not the same player as he was with the Pacers years ago. And you know, maybe Thad Young can do it a little bit, but Thad's more of like a normal power forward these days, you know, not used to chasing perimeter guys around as much. You mentioned Teague's ankle too. I think we'll see again, the Cavaliers have had a lot of success against Teague in the playoffs the last 2 years, going under on pick and rolls and, you know, making Teague beat them from the outside. I think Teague can be effective getting to the rim if healthy, because this is a team that has so little rim protection, you know, especially if he's getting in a pick and roll with Love and Irving. I think he can be effective there. And you wonder, I guess it's going to be Irving trying to guard Teague. So that'll be an issue potentially for the Pacers. But if it's Thompson switching out onto Teague, then can Teague actually beat Thompson if they lay off and let Teague shoot a three? Or, you know, what are they going to do there? I mean, I would like to see them maybe get that switch early in possessions and then try to let Paul George go to work at that point. with nobody really there to protect the rim, or maybe let Monte Ellis try and attack. That's one question. I think the biggest strategic question for me is what McMillan is going to do at shooting guard. I mean, he really has three options there now in Stevenson, CJ Miles, and Monte Ellis. He's largely has closed games with Ellis. Ellis closed that game lately. He closed that double overtime game. I still think that Miles is by far the better option, especially because Cleveland late in games loves to go to those small pick and rolls, and Ellis provides another liability there. Anything else you see from a strategic standpoint that pops out to you that the coaches will be looking at?
I don't know if this counts as strategic, but I don't think we've talked enough about Kyrie Irving. Irving has been the central figure for the Cavs when he's been healthy in a lot of big games, big series. And we talked about how, you know, the Cavs don't really have that many answers for LeBron. The Pacers guard rotation does not have many answers. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah,
their Pacers guard rotation does not have many answers for Kyrie Irving.
Yeah, with George Hill being traded, I mean, I do think T gives him a little more juice off the pick and roll offensively, but yeah, I think that's a great point to me, and especially when you consider that Miles Turner effective defending the rim but not really that good in space. You have to imagine that Kyrie will be able to really work in the mid-range, get a good mid-range shot whenever he cares
that's a tactical thing.
Yeah,
when Miles Turner gets in foul trouble, because that's going to happen in this series.
Are they going to bring it Glenn Robinson III? I think he's still struggling with a calf injury. You know, who's Rakeem Christmas maybe is like the most mobile of their bigs. Lavoie Allen, like these guys are just not going to get it done. Pacers backup point guard is going to be another open sore. Like Aaron Brooks is the guy who a lot of times plays there, or they'll play Ellis there sometimes, but like those guys are going to get worked defensively. Like it's really, I just don't think this Pacers team, even with, if you're going to assume that Stevenson is going to play reasonably well, this Pacers team just does not have enough good players, and they can't take advantage of a Cavs team that kind of has the same problem. But I mean, especially those second units with LeBron and a bunch of shooters around him, I think those units are just going to completely destroy Indiana, and that a lot of these games will be won and lost in those time periods.
And the Miles Turner foul issue can also rear its head in the idea of that if they need him to scale up in minutes, that can be the constraint on doing that for big men, is just, can you stay in the game?
Yeah, and you can also see Paul George potentially getting in foul trouble trying to guard LeBron in a game or two as well, so that could be another issue. Anything else that pops out to you about this series before we move on?
No, that's about it. Oh, well, we need to make predictions.
yes. Well, I was making sure we were ready for that. All right, well, so yeah. You have to go first this time.
I do. I have been leaning Cavs in six this whole time. I don't know exactly why. I think it's partially because I feel like it can go seven just because of the way Cleveland's playing right now, and it could go five. So so when I'm legitimately unsure between three options, I kind of choose the middle one. And I have no fear of Cleveland's ability to win in Indiana. That's not a concern for me at all. So I have no, you know, it's not picking something uncommon for that reason. So I'm going to go Cavs in six. This conversation made me turn a little bit more towards Cavs in five than I was before, but I'm staying with six.
Yeah, you know, I just don't quite believe in the Pacers defense enough. I think they just have no chance of slowing down this Cavs team. And even though they may have some games where they score pretty well themselves, I mean, they're just not built to shoot enough threes to keep up with Cleveland when they're at their best. And maybe the Cavs will miss some threes and that have some games where they go, you know, 10 out of 40 from 3-point range. But I'm going to go Cavs five. I think especially with LeBron able to play even more minutes now, though he was playing a lot in the regular season, but I think the Pacers don't have the personnel really to exploit the lack of big men. Teague's injury is concerning to me as well. You know, I mean, he definitely has ankle sprains and is able to play on those in the past, but you know, the fact that he had to just go straight to the locker room in that game was a little concerning to me. So I'll believe that he's fully healthy when I see him. And with all that being the case, yeah, I think I'll go Cavs five. Are we writing these down, by the way? We should probably write these down. I'll create a Google Doc for this afterwards. Let's move on now to the 3-6 series, one that I'm probably looking forward to second most among all these playoff series, Toronto and Milwaukee.
Lots of fun all over the court, but where I want to start this conversation is Chris Middleton and DeMar DeRozan. Middleton is an underrated defender, but I'm legitimately unsure how he's going to fare in that particular matchup, because I think of DeRozan as being worse against kind of stronger maybe even a little bit longer, like more small forward types. But I do think Middleton can do a good job.
Yeah, that does appear like it's going to be the matchup. One advantage that the Bucks have is Toronto really likes to try to get DeRozan switched on at point guards. Malcolm Brogdon, I think, is just about as good as it gets to match up with DeRozan as a point guard, because the way that DeRozan scores, I actually think Middleton, just from a physical standpoint, can do okay. The way DeRozan scores is he's not really beating anybody with quickness. He's kind of working to his spot. He's getting his shoulder into guys and creating room for his mid-ranger, which he can then elevate. I think that Middleton is a pretty strong guy. He actually operates in very similar fashion himself on the offensive end, although doesn't have, you know, quite the scoring prowess that DeRozan has. And then, you know, Brogdon, if they need him to switch on, and of course Giannis as well, even someone like Thon Maker can hang with DeRozan a little bit too, if Maker is going to play. So I think I like the Bucks' ability to defend DeRozan. Kyle Lowry maybe not quite as much, but it is going to be very interesting, because this isn't a Toronto team, especially now that they don't have Terrence Ross, that shoots it incredibly well. The Bucks are very, very aggressive defensively, and they like to take the ball out of guys' hands. Lowry, DeRozan, on those pick and rolls, I think they might really try and blitz them, make other guys beat them. It'll be interesting to see. That's the number one strategic issue here, is Toronto really going to be able to beat that strategy with these Bucks athletes running all over the floor? I think that this Bucks team, to the extent that they do succeed defensively, does it by really surprising people, overwhelming them, where you don't see that strategy as often in the regular season. I think given time to really get used to it, that Toronto will get better at going against them defensively throughout the course of the series. That's one argument. The other argument you can make, though, is that this Toronto offense, especially late in games, is very station to station. They don't have a ton of flow, and they're pretty predictable themselves. And so it might be easier for the Bucks than on a team like, say, you know, a Utah that really moves the ball a lot and like gets a lot of corner threes. You don't see that as much from Toronto. So I think that's going to be the big matchup to me. I want to see what happens Toronto's offense against this Bucks defense.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. And your idea of how stagnant the Toronto offense gets late is important, because I think Milwaukee has good personnel to handle them when they're stagnant. You know, the one-on-one matchups in this series, while they're, you know, Brogdon is young, I think you can do a decent enough job on Lowry, Middleton, on DeMar DeRozan. And that ties in with the other one that I'm really interested in, which is if Dwayne Casey goes with Ibaka at center to close or for various moments, how does Jason Kidd react to that? It could be Thon Maker. It could be a few other things, but I don't see
it. I would be shocked if it was Thon Maker. I mean,
but like none of their other guys, like, are they going to use Greg Monroe at center in those circumstances?
I mean, I think if it were me, I probably could just put Monroe on PJ Tucker. I don't think Tucker is like such a good shooter. Now, I mean, that's the question with Kidd. I mean, Kidd is, I shouldn't have scoffed at Maker, because Kidd definitely is like, you know, Mr. Recency bias. Like, he will go with whoever he thinks is playing well, you know, in the last 30 seconds. That's who's going to be out there.
It's also for me an issue of just the Bucks not having that many other options. I mean, I could see him just getting mad, as, you know, Henson could struggle in those lineups. Monroe could struggle defensively. And you're right that putting Monroe or Henson on a different player might be a way of making that work. I also don't think Dwayne Casey is creative enough to really exacerbate a lot of those issues, but I don't know exactly how they're going to play it. And I'm also interested in what role Mirza Teletovic plays in this series. His ability to just nail beyond the break threes is unusual and something that teams can have trouble adjusting to. But I also don't think he's going to play enough to necessarily swing that many games.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see whether he or Beasley gets more time. And you mentioned Middleton potentially guarding DeRozan. You know, it might even be that Tony Snell is the one who starts on him as well. I that's the one matchup I don't like quite as much. Snell has improved. He's gotten stronger. He has good length, but not really athletic enough. And I think DeRozan is way stronger than him. I think DeRozan can be effective in that matchup more than maybe against Middleton. But we'll see. I mean, Middleton, he's not that quick, but I do think he's a little bit stronger. It'd be interesting to see. But for those three guys on the perimeter and then Giannis at the four, that is a very, very switchable lineup. So any 1-4 pick and roll involving DeRozan or Lowry, I think that the Bucks could switch that pretty effectively. It's just then, you know, what are they doing at center? I think Greg Monroe, this is, I think, I know that Kidd has been starting Thon Maker. I would think very seriously about starting Greg Monroe, having him match up on the defensive glass against Jonas Valanciunas, because I think some of these Raptors lineups, the Lowry plus bench lineup, the closing lineup perhaps, are not as good at matchups for Monroe if they're playing Ibaka at center.
Right. I think that's a sound piece of logic, especially considering there would be places for guys like Thon Maker at other points in the game if they want to incorporate him, and there are fewer places for Monroe. I also don't think they're going to use a floor spacing center as much to take advantage of Valanciunas' limitations in that realm. So you might as well use the guy who kind of plays into it and gives you maybe not an advantage, but keeps it close in that way.
The start of the second quarter, we keep saying this, but I mean, so many of these playoff games are won and lost in these times, start of the fourth quarter. The Bucks, the last two Bucks games I've seen at least, have been take Giannis out with about 6 minutes left in the first quarter. Presumably they'll reduce that a little bit. And then he actually has been starting the second quarter. That, of course, is when the famous Lowry plus bench units will get to work. So I do like that for the Bucks, that they'll at least have some of their best player out there in theory during that time, if the matchups continue or the rotations continue to go the way they have in the regular season. What we haven't talked much about Toronto defending this Bucks team. How do you see that shaking out?
It's going to be a real challenge for them, because when they use Giannis as an initiator, which they do not always do, of course, it's a convoluted kind of mechanism on that team. I don't really trust any of the Bucks forwards in terms of that as a one-to-one matchup, and depending on how they use screens and everything like that. And the underrated weak point for them is if DeMar DeRozan consistently loses Middleton, because Middleton gets loose and gets open, and Giannis or whoever else can find him for that pass. And if he hits, 40% or whatever of his threes in those circumstances, it might create a margin that gets a little bit harder for Toronto to match.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. Kidd likes to go to his own small pick and rolls, ISOs down the end of games as well. And teams, for whatever reason, tried to do that against Kyle Lowry. And Lowry has slipped defensively this year, but he's strong. He's not someone that is just easy meat for a larger player. I always felt like teams should isolate DeRozan more on those plays. And they just haven't really, for whatever reason, they don't do that. I think teams don't actually really understand what a non-competitor he is defensively. We'll see whether that happens. Another thing that I'm concerned with is I think Kidd is going to play Jason Terry way too much in this series. I think Terry should be playing 5 minutes a game. They have guys in Snell, Middleton, with him being back now, Brogdon, Dellavedova, although he's struggled at times this year. I would rather they play Teletovic and play a little bigger than go with Terry, who can hit a shot every once in a while, and he's a vet, but he's pretty washed up at this point, and someone who can really be exploited defensively, although I've been impressed with his effort this year, but he's 39 years old or whatever it is. So I think that they're gonna have to not do that. I think where they slot in Monroe, I do think that Toronto has a big coaching advantage in this one, and they also just have a lot of great personnel. With Patterson, PJ Tucker, Ibaka, part of why I'm so excited about this series is I think that these are two teams that really now can play very versatile, have a lot of athletes, can switch a lot of things, can be deployed in a lot of different ways, and I do trust Dwayne Casey to do a little better job of that than Jason Kidd. I think Kidd's coaching, especially how ad hoc he is just not really going to work very well in the playoffs, where you have to be so much more concerned about what your specific matchup is at a given time.
How are you feeling about the forward combination, especially in terms of guarding Giannis? I keep on thinking the Raptors have these structural...
PJ Tucker is going to put Giannis on lock when they match up, I think. I think that Giannis is not a guy who's going to blow by, doesn't have a great jump shot, and Tucker is just really good at getting into guys. Giannis will not have the strength advantage
give him space
on him. Yeah. Maybe if Valanciunas is in the game, it'll be different, but I expect that Valanciunas' minutes are going to be, 20 or below at this time. The one danger is that I think Valanciunas could be very effective offensively at the beginning of games, especially if he's matched up with Maker. And so Casey needs to not get too excited about that success and start playing him instead of Ibaka at center or down the end of games. And also, I think if they play Tucker at the three, I could see them maybe start struggling to score a little bit. You know, I think he really needs to play at the four, and they also have Patterson who can play some four as well. That'll be an interesting decision of whether it'll be Tucker, Jamari Carroll, whether Norman Powell will get back in the mix. He's been out of the rotation with Daylon Wright playing more. Whether it's Tucker at the three, Patterson at the four, Tucker at the four, that's going to be a lot to sort out as well. And then wonder if Valanciunas fits in. I mean, I could see Valanciunas kind of getting the Keith Bogans. Maybe you bring him back in at some point, you know, in the second quarter, just to get him like a few minutes, but hopefully they won't play him too much down the end of games, because I think he could have success against Maker, who is, you know, for all of his talent, is probably always going to be a bad defensive rebounder, and Valanciunas is just going to like shove him over the baseline on every offensive rebound attempt.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm trying. Is there anything else that you feel like we need to discuss from this series?
It's an interesting one to wrap my head around. I think that Toronto can be a lot better than Milwaukee in the clutch, both because they'll be playing their best lineup with Ibaka at center, because I think that Milwaukee, for all Giannis's gifts, he's not great at just creating a shot himself down the end of games. They do have DeRozan and Lowry. I think that those guys are more experienced, better guys at creating shots than really anyone that Milwaukee has. How concerned are you about Lowry's health? I mean, I think I'm ready to assume he's just going to be fine. He looks pretty good.
I'm not particularly concerned. He has looked good since he got back. I mean, you always have a little bit of doubt, but that has been reduced not only by the way he has played, but the minutes he has played.
Yeah, and I mean, he's shot the ball pretty well on pull-up threes. That's the big thing that's made him so good this year. I mean, he's shooting well over 40% on threes on some pretty difficult attempts. So, you know, there's always the potential that Lowry could have like some inexplicably bad series and just, you know, not for whatever reason, just not be able to shoot again. Like that just seems to happen to him sometimes in the playoffs. But I'm willing to just kind of think that that's more noise, at least as of right now, especially against, you know, this isn't like an elite opponent or anything. It's not an opponent with a ton of playoff experience. I mean, Giannis, this will be his first playoffs as like really a main guy. Monroe has never been in the playoffs before. Brogdon is a rookie, though an experienced one. Maker, Dellavedova at least has some experience, but, you know, he's not really one of their main guys anymore. Snell, this will be really his first major playoff experience as well. And Toronto, I mean, they just have a ton of experience at this point. So I think that's another component. It's my turn to pick here. I'm going to go Toronto in five.
I'm going Toronto in six. I originally thought seven, but I think this is a nice little kind of tie back. I said that the Bulls were really hurt in their series by the guys they traded away. And I think the reason Toronto is going to win this series is the moves that they made at the deadline. If they didn't have Ibaka and they didn't have PJ Tucker, if this theoretical matchup had happened that way, we of course don't know if it would have, I might not have even picked them to win the series. But I think that those guys make it so much harder for what Milwaukee does well that they have a very, very good chance in this series.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, and also just looking at the fundamentals, I mean, Toronto, even with Lowry missing just about every game since the All-Star break, by far the best point differential in the East. Milwaukee, their 17-10 record, I think they actually had a negative net rating despite that since the All-Star break. So they are a little bit of a paper tiger to me, kind of got lucky during the season. So that's why I'm going Toronto in five. I will get to our last series, Hawks-Wizards, in a second, and then do our overall playoff predictions for the finals and whatnot. But first, this from our friends at Betterment. Betterment is lower cost automated investing. It's lower cost than most traditional financial services. And they have a couple of tools. More than two, but the two that I find most interesting, a tax impact preview. So if you are going to withdraw, move your funds around, they will give you an indication of how that's going to change your taxes. And they also have smart deposit. You can set your smart deposit to withdraw a certain amount from your bank account each month. Or if you get above a certain preset limit, like say we need $5,000 for day-to-day expenses, anything above $5,000, you can just set it to withdraw that way. So it's great for freelancers, independent contractors like Danny and I, to still invest when you don't even necessarily have as steady of a regular income. The way to get started with Betterment, betterment.com/capspace will get you up to 6 months of no fees. That's betterment.com/capspace, Betterment Investing Made Better. All right, well, I'm glad we waited to do the best for last, right?
I have to say, though, that part of the reason why I've been frustrated with the Hawks the last little while is unfair, because it was the time they played without Paul Millsap, and they've been a lot more intriguing and better when he's been on the floor.
Yeah, I mean, if this is, we're going to anoint this as the worst series, which it might be Spurs-Grizz, but probably not, I'd say it would be this series. This series definitely has probably like the least intriguing overall talent in it. And it's a lot less crappy than the worst series in a lot of years.
Agreed, absolutely.
And the Hawks, while they do have a negative point differential overall, are the worst team in the playoffs by quite a bit by that metric. They've had some moments this year where they've played extremely well. I mean, they won 3 out of 4 against Cleveland, for example, including an early season victory there when the Cavs were actually playing really well. You know, they've run off some really nice stretches of playing well, and then they've had some awful stretches, like when Millsap was out, when they lost like 10 of 11 after that 9-2 start. But I think the Hawks defense is something that I really think can be very good. Dwight Howard's still a quality defensive player. Millsap, I mean, those two guys are right up there with the best defensive front courts in the league. When Howard is engaged, they've got a good stopper on the wing in Tabo Cephalosha. The backcourt is less exciting. The bench is a lot less exciting from a defensive standpoint. So I do think that they can slow down this Hawks or this Wizards attack a little bit. But the biggest problem for Atlanta has been an inability to score. And then for the Wizards standpoint, they haven't been able to stop anybody since the All-Star break.
Right. I mean, both these teams have an identical negative 1.7 net rating since the All-Star break, which is strange. I can't recall a time that two teams ever had that had the exact same number, but they did it in
it's negative too for both these teams.
Right.
I mean,
here's an interesting part about it. So they're both a negative 1.7. The Hawks are 101 offense and the Wizards are 109 offense. So the Wizards are doing it by not stopping anybody and the Hawks are doing it by not scoring on anybody.
Yeah. And the Hawks in particular without Millsap, that's when they really just could not score. I mean, and if you look too at some of the offensive ratings from some of their bench guys, are just horrific, like well into like the mid-90s, like really bad. Both the mid-90s in terms of number and in terms of style, is how often they're scoring. What I was going to say, though, that I now can't remember is nothing. So let's move on to discussing some of the lineup issues. I think one of the big ones to watch for me is going to be how long of a leash is Mike Budenholzer going to give Dennis Schroeder? Because the Hawks, a number of times this year, have played better without him in the lineup.
Right, and John Wall is the type of point guard that can give Schroeder a lot of trouble. He's very crafty. He can be a master in the pick and roll. His chemistry with Gortat is fantastic. They have one of the best pick and roll chemistries in the league. So he can make Schroeder frustrated. And also, as we've seen sometimes in person, Schroeder has sometimes when he gets a little bit turnover happy, that's also when Budenholzer gets very frustrated with him. And John Wall, while not the defensive force in the regular season that he has been before, could very well be kind of rearing to ramp that up. I don't know for sure. I'm not saying that with any confidence, but I do want to acknowledge the possibility.
Yeah, that is a good point. I mean, this is another one of these series where, you know, we may see the Wizards go under a lot on Schroeder, and we'll see whether he can actually make that jumper. He largely has not throughout his career, but he can get hot on occasion. You know, there might be one game where he really is on fire and then he can't hit anything the rest of the series. I could see it kind of going that way. But I also think that defensively, you mentioned the Schroeder Wall matchup. Schroeder actually had some success guarding Bradley Beal when these teams matched up 2 years ago. Schroeder a little bit, Beal not really a post guy. He likes to run off screen. Schroeder maybe a little bit more equipped to do that. And then they might go with a little more size on Wall in with someone like Tabo Cephalosha, who missed this
or
series.
Or recall.
Yeah. Or Bazemore is another one.
Bazemore is very comfortable guarding on Ball. That's something actually back when he was a rookie, he and I talked about that he was actually pretty comfortable doing that.
Yeah, and I think we saw Budenholzer go to that strategy with Damari Carroll guarding Wall a couple of years ago in some of those close games that they had in that series. So I think we could see that happen again, that would be the strategy. Also, you know, what happens with Otto Porter if they try to hide someone on Otto Porter, get more size onto both Beal and Wall? Are they going to go to Porter in the post? Is he just going to spot up and like try and shoot? You know, what's going to be the strategy there? We'll see whether, you know, this Washington three-point shooting is going to hold up a lot. And then of course the other thing that we should talk about too, which I think would be more important in this series, is that Jan Mahimi, probably the best defensive player for Washington, made it back, was playing well at the same time as Gortat kind of fell off because he looked a little bit more tired after playing so many minutes in the beginning of the year. And then now he has a calf injury and, you know, his availability is in question. And you know what we always say about calf injuries, they always seem to take longer than the prognosis actually is.
He would have provided not only a good backup center, but a nice fail safe for if Gortat got in foul trouble or just was ineffective for certain moments. As their best defensive center, it's nice to have that kind of change of pace, especially considering Atlanta's backups can be flawed. Mike Muscala's had a pretty solid season. I think that he's done well. But also something we're going to get to see now, just because Millsap has missed so much time, is Ersan Ilyasova is probably going to slide in just as the straight backup four, unless they feel more comfortable with Chris Humphries. And I think that could end up being really good for Ilyasova.
Yeah, that's a possibility. And we'll see also, is Brooks going to go small now on the second unit? He probably will. It'll probably be Jason Smith at center, who actually has been taking some threes. You know, both he and Muscala are somewhat similar players. Muscala may be a little bit more comfortable protecting the rim and as a three-point shooter, but you know, Smith maybe a little bit more higher of a volume guy. And then are they going to play Kelly Oubre at the backup for Budenholzer's part? You know, they have Ilyasova. You mentioned that he's been a backup four for them. They also at times have gone with Tabo Sefolosha as a backup four. Is Scott Brooks going to go small at the end of games? That's another question too. Will they go with Markieff Morris at center and play Oubre or Bojan Bogdanovic in the closing lineup rather than Gortat? We'll see how effective Gortat can be. And they might feel, hey, you know, if Howard is in there, we're going to get killed on the offensive glass. Howard has quietly had a great offensive rebounding season. So we got to go with Gortat. Or do they say, hey, we're just going to space out Howard? And then does Budenholzer play Howard at the end of the game as well, or do they go with, you know, a little more mobility? Maybe they could go with Millsap at center as well. I think it wouldn't shock me if we see some games here where it's Millsap at center versus Markieff at center down the stretch.
Absolutely could see that, especially because the Hawks have a kind of an interesting eclectic collection of wings now. They traded Kyle Korver, of course, during the year, with Dunleavy, with Tim Hardaway Jr., who has done a nice job closing some games, with Kent Bazemore and Torian Prince. Like, I could totally see them having more trust, especially if the Wizards go small, and just rolling with some of those guys.
Yeah, Mike Budenholzer really just has a cornucopia of wing options. He's got Bazemore, Sefolosha is back from injury, Tim Hardaway has played well, he's one of the best net ratings on the team. He actually has shown the ability to handle in pick and roll a little bit. I think that's something they're really going to need, is someone else with some juice off the bounce, especially if they're not going to close with Schroeder. They've got Mike Dunleavy. Prince has been playing well of late as well, you know, so they have the firepower to go small at the four. They can go Ilyasova also, Muscala, Dwight Howard at center. I mean, they have a lot of depth now on this Hawks team. I think if they had a better point guard option, I would be a much bigger believer in them. But Schroeder, you know, we've talked about his limitations many times on this show. I'm not a believer that he's really going to be able to have a very good series, maybe outside of one or two games here.
They're going to have at least, and I'm referring to the Hawks, they're going to have at least one game in this series where they just absolutely can't score. It might even be two or three. And I think that's going to be what cost them their best shot of winning the series.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, Washington's defense has kind of sucked, and we'll see whether Brooks can find the combinations to fix that. I mean, to me, that's what it's going to be about, because with Wall and Beal, I think they can, and Porter, I think they can score pretty well. It's just if they can find some kind of a combination at the four and five, because those three guys are obviously going to be out there. Markieff is probably going to be out there too. If they can just find some way, I mean, and I think also maybe what it's going to be too, the advantage of going small is switching everything, because Howard not really an option in the post anymore, and so this Hawks team has some strengths, but they don't really have anyone who could beat a switching defense. Cleveland has killed them with that. Cleveland has killed them with going under, and it's not the same team, but Millsap and Schroeder certainly are still there. They've played key roles in the past, so I do think that I like going a little bit smaller, because now you just force the Hawks to beat you one-on-one, and they don't really have anyone that I look at as an above-average one-on-one player.
Another benefit for the Wizards, as much as their bench got better with adding Bojan Bogdanović and everything, Wall, Beal, and Porter playing a higher proportion of the team's minutes could really transform some of their biggest flaws, even without Jan Mahimi.
Yeah, that's a great point, too, because backup point guard, I mean, they did get Jennings, but he has been very inefficient. You know, we may not see that much of him in this series.
For reference, the last 2 years, the two times he's made the playoffs, he's played between 38 and 39 minutes a game, whereas he's around 35, 36 in the regular season. And considering the stakes of this series, it could even go higher.
Yeah, I think that might be brought down by the fact that he suffered that wrist injury in the series before. I mean, and Washington surely will be wanting revenge for that, even though, as we said, it's a different Hawks team. Another smaller rotational issue for Mike Budenholzer: is he going to go with Malcolm Delaney or Jose Calderon as the backup point guard? Calderon really cannot be on the floor with John Wall at the same time. That's just not going to work. And I think Delaney is better defensively. I think he's got a little bit more juice in the pick and roll, although, you know, neither of them really have been that great from getting to the basket for quite some time. But I do think Delaney is better than Calderon, but Calderon, I think, has been playing a little bit more than Delaney during this period. Calderon certainly someone that I think is just going to get totally taken advantage of with his massive weaknesses defensively. Whereas Delaney, you know, not some stud player, but at least he's a guy who's like, you're not just going to go right at him every single time.
There also aren't many places to hide Calderon in the way that I think that Washington's going to run their rotations. So it gets a lot harder to put him on the floor.
Yeah, this will be very interesting. Budenholzer's coaching in the playoffs has left something to be desired for me at times. Scott Brooks has been better this year. It'll be interesting to see how he does in his first playoffs outside of Oklahoma City. That'll be another interesting thing to watch. And then, you know, foul trouble, I think, is something that could be a big issue more for Washington, especially with Gortat and Jason Smith, who is very foul prone as well. I mean, those are the only two traditional bigs that they even have available who are even, you know, remotely proven players. So that could be a big problem. And Mahimi, you know, he's out 7 to 10 days. So I think the earliest he could possibly return would be game four.
They're going to miss him a lot. They really are. Anything else you feel like we need to discuss in this before we go to predictions?
No, I think that's probably about it. I think it's your turn to go first, actually.
It is. For a long time, I was leaning Wizards in five and then realized that was way too harsh on the Hawks. So I ended up with Wizards in six, though I could see this going seven and I could see the Hawks winning.
Yeah, this is one where I do think they match up okay with this Washington team. I mean, if they were playing against a team that has been effective defensively. Now, I guess we should note that Washington was good defensively earlier in the year, and they've been better defensively in the past. And you mentioned Wall's variable effort level, shall we say. So maybe they'll turn it up defensively and the Hawks will really struggle to score. I'm less optimistic about the Wizards defense than you are when you're saying there might be some games where the Hawks just can't score at all. These are also two teams that don't have like the greatest home court advantage in the world, so I don't see that really playing in quite as much as it might necessarily in another series. I'm going to go with the Wizards in seven. I realize that this Hawks team has been, you know, their fundamentals are not that good, but I think that they are a little bit better. You know, I think their actual talent level is a little bit more in line with what their record is rather than what their point differential is, if I really had to pick it. It's just, you know, if Schroeder implodes, I could end up looking really stupid here. He is just the big weakness for this Hawks team. I think other than that, they kind of match up pretty well. And, you know, we'll see what ends up happening. I mean, the Wizards definitely have more star talent, but I'm just, they're playing so poorly themselves that I don't necessarily want to say that they're going to win a series against anybody in less than seven at this particular time.
Yeah, it's certainly fair, especially considering Millsap will be the best player on the floor for at least a couple of these games.
All right, so why don't we do just briefly, let's go through the whole bracket. I mean, we can certainly revise this as we get into previewing individual series once we know what they are. But second round, you and I both have Warriors versus Clippers. I assume you would have the Warriors advancing in that series.
Yeah. Do you want a number of games or do you just want the winner?
No, I think it's too early for number of games.
That's fair. I'm good with that.
Who do you think they will be facing in the Western Conference Finals?
Ugh, I could see that the Spurs Rocket series, which we both have, going either way. I'm going to go Spurs. I think that they'll figure out kind of some of their rotational stuff. That could be an absolutely wonderful series.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough to make picks because they're just like, I don't really believe that well in any of these teams right now. I mean, the more I think about it, like, I mean, Cleveland obviously has a ton of talent. So do the Spurs. But, you know, it's really hard to just be like so fired up. I mean, like, you know, nobody had a net rating more than like 8 or something, I think, other than the Warriors. Yeah, that Houston San Antonio series is going to be really tough. I think I'm going to go Houston. I think I'm going to do it. I reserve the right to change my pick once we actually get into that series. But as of right now, I think that Houston, just their style is going to cause too many problems for San Antonio. And that Popovich is going to be a little bit too rigid in terms of going with the two bigs, and they don't have any practice playing Houston style. I think Houston is going to force them to conform to their style, and that, you know, I think Harden has usually played pretty well against the Spurs. So we'll see. I mean, I could feel stupid because Kawhi like locks down Harden the whole series. But, you know, I think the shooting might just be a little bit too much to deal with. What about?
I will make a small note that, at least speaking for myself, I do not feel bad at all about changing how I feel about a second round or third round or NBA finals based on what happens. I will use that information. I'm not going to pick a series because I picked it in the past. I'm going to use the all available information moving forward.
Yeah, this like, oh, I picked this at the beginning of the year, and now, you know, well, I picked Houston for 46 wins, so they're going to lose in the first round. Like, I never really understood that thinking. Like, you know, it's you're trying to just do the best you can with the available information. There's a lot more information available now. So
especially this year, we're like in the playoffs, I feel like I'm going to get a better sense of some of these teams.
All right, so I had the Warriors then beating whoever they play, Houston, in the conference finals. I also would have them beating whoever comes out of the East. And I think that they can do it pretty comfortably as well. You never know. But what about in the Eastern Conference? I mean, this is another one of these ones where like, all right, are we really going to believe in the Cavs again this year or no?
I am. And them facing the Raptors in the second round is going to be a lot of fun if that's what happens, because I think the Raptors are their biggest threat in the conference. I do expect Cleveland to win that series, but that could go 7. That could be a spectacular series. Celtics, Wizards are both teams that I don't have a lot of faith in right now, but I have substantially more faith at this moment in the Celtics than the Wizards, so I'll pick that, and they have home court, so then pick Cavs Celtics in the conference finals, and the Cavs win that, you know, not like a sweep or anything, but I think that they'd win it somewhat comfortably, maybe actually somewhat like the Raptors series the last couple of years.
Yeah, I do like whoever comes out of that 2-3 matchup to take it in the East. And yeah, I mean, the more I think about it, it's just like really getting into the matchups and thinking about like what some of the weaknesses of these teams are. I mean, this Raptors team doesn't have a ton of weaknesses at this point. Like it's, I mean, other than DeRozan defensively, Yeah, we'll see. But I mean, I think that's helped by the fact that they're going to be playing more shooting now with Ibaka at center. You know, they can spread the floor. That simple offense can work a lot better when you have shooting around it and you can't just load up. So,
well, and they'll be better defensively, so they'll get more looks in transition.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, Kyle Lowry could lay an egg, and, you know, these guys don't have a ton of chemistry together yet. You know, Ibaka and Tucker playing with Lowry. But no, I mean, I like this Raptors team. It's too bad for them that they're going to have to play Cleveland in the second round. But I do think Cleveland will get there. I think that their hardest series will be the Raptors, not Boston, and that they then will make it to the finals. And I expect the Warriors to win that one.
I have one off the wall question for you.
Oh yeah, let's hear it.
Before the season, I went on Josh Lloyd's podcast. He does Locked In Fantasy Basketball, and he asked me because I was doing the Warriors podcast, for a bold prediction. And my off the cuff prediction was that, and I'm not standing by this now necessarily, but it was that the Warriors would lose 5 or fewer games in the playoffs. Do you have a call on that?
So that means they go 4-1 in 3 series and then 4-2 in another series. Yeah, I would be on board with that. I mean, they're just like, nobody else is really that sexy right now, to be honest. And especially with KD back, he looked a little bit better. the way that Steph is really rounding into form now too. I mean, that's another one with him playing so well. I mean, if we were getting, December Steph Curry at this moment, I think it'd be a little bit different, but Steph is obviously going to be very motivated, and I'm definitely a believer in what he's going to do. I know he feels like, part of his playoffs was taken from him last year and he wasn't able to quite be himself. So I think he's going to be very motivated. I mean, for a shooter, being motivated maybe doesn't matter as much as it does for someone like LeBron, who can dominate the game athletically. But I would put it right on five as a good over under, maybe even 4.5.
Wow. Yeah, it's going to, this whole thing. And also, we'll see what teams we feel better about, what teams we feel worse about in like a couple weeks. And that's also ties in with the last thing, kind of thing I wanted to mention, which is this first weekend is always a blast. Like, it's always so much fun because you get the first game in every series. But I think there's so many teams this year that I'm still trying to figure out, and I'm trying to figure out how they fare. Like Wizards Hawks is a great example of this. I feel like I'm going to have a better sense of where that's going after game one, even though it won't be definitive.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what Giannis can be in the playoffs. I mean, there's some great individual matchups as well. But I mean, just going back to that Warriors thing, and the Warriors had the fourth best point differential in NBA history this year, and there's probably like nobody else who's in the top 100 right now. I haven't looked at it, but I mean, it is a very, very mediocre year other than the Golden State Warriors. And so that's, I mean, it just looking at any, if you believe in any kind of statistical analysis, and then also just looking at the fact that they have four all-stars on their team and two top five players in the league, you would have to expect that they're going to roll on it. And really the only way I see that getting derailed is if LeBron James and the Cavs just like really have some type of a renaissance here that, and frankly, like, I mean, the Cavs, they got to get to a level far beyond the level that they were at in last year's finals when they went down 3-1 anyway to even think about competing with this Warriors team.
It's a great point.
All right, I think we're done here. Thanks so much to our sponsors, Betterment. You can find out more about them at betterment.com/capspace for up to 6 months of no fees at lower cost automated investing. And HBO, the J. Cole special, for your eyes only. Thanks so much to them for sponsoring. J. Cole, For Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film, will air Saturday, April 15th at 10 Eastern, 11 Pacific. It is the Grammy-nominated hip-hop star's second HBO special, a multi-narrative show that combines music performances with intimate interviews documented through his lens. The revealing footage contains the heartfelt confessions, concerns, and struggles of people in the American South. Cole reveals the challenges that lower-income residents face in trying to obtain viable housing, discusses the integration in small towns like Jonesboro, Arkansas, where his father grew up. So tune in Saturday, April 15th, 10 Eastern, 11 Pacific, for the premiere of J. Cole, For Your Eyes Only, a Dreamville film, exclusively on HBO.